Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Other Hand. I think I should probably start off today with a slight apology that my sound quality might not be great because I'm operating out of Dungarvan this week and I haven't proper studio as such set up yet. So there's a lot of sound bouncing around the place. And Chris, as an amateur sound engineer, you know how soft furnishing and bookshelves and so on can make such a difference. So I apologize in advance, but I'm working on it. I want to start off today by talking about what's happening on the inflation front around the world. Yesterday, we got the flash estimate of harmonized inflation. That's the EU measure for Ireland. It fell to 1.7%. That's down from 2.3% in February. So below the 2% target. And certainly, you know, we're seeing a marked deceleration. Energy prices fell by 3.1% during the month of March, down 8.4% year on year. Food prices down by 0.1% during the month of March, up 2.6% year on year. So food and energy certainly making a significant contribution. And if you exclude both of those, core inflation is running at 2.8%. I guess one note of caution here is what's happening on energy markets at the moment, particularly oil prices. Brent crude up just under $89 a barrel yesterday, which I think is the highest since about last October. So that there's some concerns there about what's happening. There's an OPEC Plus meeting later today, Wednesday, looking at future oil supply. So oil markets are a little bit nervous. And obviously, that is one thing that could certainly feed into the downward trend in consumer price inflation. This morning, we got the Eurozone inflation number, came in at 2.4%. The market had been expecting 2.6%. The core rate, excluding food and energy, running at 2.9%. So inflation across the euro area steadily moving towards the European Central Bank's target of 2% or slightly lower. German inflation has fallen to 2.2%, which is the lowest since May 21. So it would certainly appear that the battle against inflation is being won, whether it's through deliberate policy or it's just the natural course of things. People will debate that. I actually think inflation would have come down anyway, regardless of what central banks had been doing on the interest rate front. But not everybody agrees with that view of the world. In marked contrast, Chris, we had Turkish inflation came in February at 68.5%. Okay, that's what you call real inflation. And tied into that is the fact that President Erdogan had a very, very bad weekend in local elections around Turkey. So certainly the economic and inflation backdrop, particularly in Turkey, is having a very significant political impact on Erdogan's fortunes. So, you know, we could be on the brink of seeing we're already seeing the decline, but we could be on the brink of the end of one of the strongman leaders around the world, Erdogan.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see a little bit of that tide going out. Remains to be seen, as you say. I think the point you make about Europe is particularly interesting, about whether or not inflation would have come down on its own. That, I think, sits nicely with the headline in the Financial Times today, which talks about the Eurozone economy being very much a two-speed economy. And we have the remarkable set of circumstances, the unusual set of circumstances, whereby Southern Europe is growing much faster than Germany, France, and Holland. And it gives rise to an overall picture of a pretty flat Eurozone economy. And I think that has been part of the story. Most of the story is that inflation, as you say, would have come down on its own, but it's been helped by the fact that in the big three economies, nothing much is happening. Germany, it turns out, because of its reliance on cheap Russian gas, its reliance on manufacturing has been hit by the energy shock and also by the slowdown in global manufacturing. And it seems to be stuck in the doldrums. But even China is now starting to show signs of expansion in ways that Europe is not. And the big story, I think, is the United States. China's part of this global story, but the big story is the United States, where there's a great daily email from somebody called John Authors. He writes for Bloomberg, and you can get his email for free. You don't need me to read it out. But for those that don't see it, I think the opening sentence is really quite punchy today. And it begins, okay, it begins to look like we can forget about hard or soft landings. Remember, Jim, that's been the debate, the silly debate amongst economists for months now, and we've never indulged in that one. We can forget about hard or soft landings because the US economy is picking up altitude again. And that speaks to a theme that you and I have been banging on about since the beginning of the year, which is the US in particular, the world economy in general, with the notable exception of the euro area, or parts of the euro area at least, is showing signs of reaccelerating. And we've had more data from the United States and China in recent days consistent with that accelerating, gently accelerating growth story. But it's had a huge impact on the all-important interest rate markets. And the extraordinary stat that John Authors comes up with is that he shows how interest rate expectations for both Europe and the United States were as recently as the beginning of the year on January the 2nd compared to yesterday. And the number of interest rate cuts penciled in by financial markets for the whole of 2024 then compared to now has halved. So whereas before we were looking at maybe 6 or 7 interest rate cuts in both markets of about a quarter point each through the course of the year, it's now 3 or 4. And that's quite an extraordinary turnaround. And it leads to expectations for June being the earliest possible cut for the United States, for example. And there, the market, you can work these things out quite explicitly, is saying it's only 50-50. For a June rate cut. So these interest rate expectations are getting pushed back all the time. Every time we do one of these podcasts, we talk about that, and it happens again once we stop talking. And the all-important bond market, which is the longer-term interest rate here that I'm talking about, they're now talking maybe that's going to hit 5%, which we haven't seen for quite some time in the United States. So that's all on the back of a cyclical recovery in the US economy. And the stock market hasn't been affected by these changing interest rate expectations. If you'd said at the beginning of the year that the market would be wiping out half the interest rate cuts expected, you'd have said the stock market would have a torrid time. It hasn't. Over the last few days, it's stopped going up, essentially, both in Europe and the United States. But underneath the hood, there have been some big changes. The Magnificent Seven, the stocks that you and I have talked about, the Apples, Microsoft, Teslas, Metas of this world, have not been the leaders that they have been recently, but particularly Tesla and Apple have been going the wrong way. But the underneath that, there's been a broader based recovery in US stocks. And it's consistent with that acceleration in the economy and that it's been a cyclical recovery. And something that stock market types talk about is value versus growth investing. And that's something that we could get into on a dedicated stock market investing podcast. But once in a generation, value does well relative to growth. And it seems that we're in one of those periods gently now. And that's consistent, again, with cyclical economic recovery. So putting all of that together, I think that we've been right to be majoring on the fact that the world economy, ex-Europe, is accelerating. And even Europe's doing a little bit better than it was, but it's still in the doldrums. Is good, isn't it? It's a good thing in and of itself. And it's spectacularly good for small open economies heavily dependent on the world economy doing well. And can you think of one of those, Jim?
Indeed. Chris, if I could take you back a second for our listeners who may not be terribly familiar with the concepts. The difference between value stocks and growth stocks. And I guess what I'm really interested in here, your perspective on how the cyclical economic recovery story, you know, impacts on both types of stock investment strategy.
Well, when there's a recovery, economic recovery, things generally, by definition, in an, you know, the name suggests it, are doing well. And that rising tide lifts all boats. And so it lifts the best companies and it lifts the crappiest companies. Companies that would really, really struggle in a recession really are relieved when you see an economic recovery. Growth companies, in the language of stock market investors, also typically, not always typically, are what we call quality companies. That's another investing style that, amongst many other things, are resilient and, if you like, not invariant, but don't depend on the economic cycle quite so much as these so-called value stocks. And historically, at least, one of the favorite investing techniques of investors is to say that I buy cheap companies. I mean, it's fairly obvious when you think about it. Why would you buy anything that was expensive? And value investing was something, if you like, first described, I won't say invented, but first described all the way back in, I think, the 1930s by Ben Graham and adopted by by the world's greatest investor, Warren Buffett. And Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's sidekick, who sadly died recently, persuaded Warren Buffett that value investing was no longer the way to invest, that the right way to invest is to buy quality companies at a reasonable price rather than the ultra cheap, dirt cheap, somewhat dodgy in the sense of asking questions about whether or not they could survive, particularly during recession. So there's all that kind of discussion goes on, and investors separate out the returns from investing in stock market into these things called factors. And originally there were only three, really. There was value, growth, and size. And size is important because small company investing is a world unto itself as well. And then it gets even more complicated as you go through time since those first three factors were discovered, if you like, by two academics called Farmer and French. And we now have what is called a factor zoo. We have a plethora, a multitude of factors, you know, investing on Fridays, you know, tech investing, the number of styles, there are dozens and dozens of them, and to the point where your head spins and it's difficult to make any sense of them. But the point about this value investing thing that I mentioned today and that you rightly asked me about is that it does well very occasionally. It doesn't do as well as it did in the past. And I think there are lots of good reasons for that. And I don't think it will do as well in the future as it did in the past. But it's having a day in the sun. And it's likely to be a very brief day for all sorts of reasons. But it is consistent with economic recovery. It's consistent with economic acceleration. It reinforces the story that we're telling, that the world economy is doing better, and that therefore we should all take some comfort from that, both in terms of our jobs and our pension savings, and indeed other forms of saving.
Chris, there's a few other big global stories, I think, at the moment that are very relevant to what's going on. This morning, we've had an earthquake in Taiwan measuring 7.4, the strongest earthquake in that country in 25 years. And I guess the economic significance is that TSMC, which is one of the giant chip makers in Taiwan, and which by definition is then one of the giant chip makers in the world, it has had to evacuate a number of its factories. It remains to be seen, you know, how long those factories will be evacuated from. From what I'm picking up, not too long. But I think what strikes me here about this is, in the context of the China-Taiwan relationship, it just shows the potential impact of a Chinese strike on Taiwan at some stage. You know, and we've always said that in terms of the global economic environment, the real significance of Taiwan is obviously its contribution to high-end chips.
I'm going to tell you something that I would bet, without being certain, that you didn't see in recent days. I don't think anybody saw, because it's such a small piece of news. But I think it's telling, consistent with what you're saying about fears about Taiwan. There's a whole bunch of islands in the waters near Taiwan, some of which are disputed between Japan and China. And there's some islands that are not disputed. And those islands, particularly in something called the Okinawa Prefecture, in recent days, they announced a bomb shelter and fallout shelter building program to really take account of the risk of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, because they are very close to Taiwan and might get caught up in the fallout. And the shelters are being built to a specification of steel reinforced doors to at least 30 centimeters and enough food and water to last for at least 2 weeks. So some people are getting ready for it, Jim, and I think that's probably very wise. It's very sad. I hope that this is one of those just-in-case things, and we're hoping for the best but preparing for the worst. But some people are taking that threat of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan very, very seriously. But as you say, in the short term, a couple of years ago, you and I were talking almost every podcast about a shortage of silicon chips in the world. That talk, of course, has gone away. These things do have a habit of sorting themselves out. But that talk, depending on what happens next, of course, whether these factories can reopen very quickly or not, it would be serious, because the supply chain thing depends so heavily on chips of all kinds. Everybody, from the inflation perspective and from that growth perspective, you certainly don't want the global growth story to be damaged by another supply shock. I don't think this is one, but it's certainly something we need to keep an eye on. But of course, the rise in the oil price that you mentioned at the top of the show is also another growth-reducing thing. It's like a tax cut on oil importers. A tax rise on oil importers, and that also will be growth-reducing. So it's not all good news, but net-net, I do think that this positive growth story, notwithstanding those small things that we're talking about there, is very much intact.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Chris, before we move on to some global war-related stories, which I picked up on in the last couple of days, I just want to throw out some more statistics that I think are quite relevant to what's going on here in Ireland, and indeed globally, in the context of Tesla's disappointing results in recent days. But anyway, the Society of the Irish Motor Industry, which is the representative body for the Irish motor industry, and I put my head up and say I do a lot of work with the SIMI, but they published yesterday the end March new car registration data, okay, and it shows that in the first 3 months of the year, 62,807 new cars have been registered, That's up 8% on the same quarter last year, but it's still 2.1% lower than pre-COVID in 2019. But nevertheless, you know, it's proving to be a decent year for the motor industry here. But there is a significant trend emerging. Petrol doing well, hybrid cars doing very well, but the EV market is under pressure. Sales in the first 3 months down by 14.3%. And this is I think, reflecting lots of factors. But, you know, I definitely think the first wave of EV purchasers who could afford to buy an EV and who had an environmental desire to drive an EV, those first wave of movers have now come through the market. The second wave is more price conscious and is particularly more conscious about range anxiety and the lack of proper charging infrastructure, the cost of charging, all of those factors. So the EV project here, and indeed it seems to be the same everywhere at the moment, is under a little bit of pressure.
Yeah, interesting. And of course, that also ties in with the China story. Because one of the things that both European and American policymakers are terrified of is a wave of much cheaper Chinese imports of EVs, because they seem to have found a way, whether it's through efficiency gains or subsidies, nobody's quite sure. The reason why I think policymakers are frightened of it is because it is because of Chinese subsidies. The maker of Chinese electronic vehicles, 100% EVs, is producing them at a rate of knots that is certainly scaring Tesla. The Tesla is not doing nearly so well in China as it did, not nearly doing so well globally as it did. And so, yeah, I think that we are in one of those interesting phases where the initial wave of enthusiasm is giving away to a bit of cold reality, a couple of geopolitical factors as well. I think geopolitically, they don't want to be flooded with Chinese imports of EVs either, whether or not they were subsidized. So I think that this is going to continue. My feeling, though, and it's not based on any great scientific knowledge, is that we await longer range cars and charging infrastructure, as you say. Both the UK and Ireland is pretty hopeless at building out charging infrastructure, and we need to get that right before there is, shall we say, wholesale adoption of EVs. And getting that charging infrastructure right, getting over range anxiety, would appear to be in the distant rather than the near future, would be my guess.
Yeah, I actually went EV last week for the first time. And my initial drive was from Dublin to Dungarvan last Friday.
How far is that?
It's about 220 kilometers or thereabouts.
And you did you need to recharge, or did you do it in one charge?
I came down, there was another 150, 160 kilometers left in the battery. And I haven't actually driven the car since, because I don't drive very much, only on long journeys. I cycle, walk, as you know, everywhere. But yeah, it's been an interesting experiment again. So here I am, Chris. In recent weeks, I've dipped my toe in Bitcoin. I'm now gone electric. What the hell are you expecting next?
You're a pioneer, Jim, in all senses of the term. I wasn't going to mention Bitcoin because I didn't want to embarrass you, but seeing as you brought it up, how's your investment doing?
Yeah, it's funny. I was here in Dungarvan over the weekend and some random individual said to me on the street, "I see you've dipped your toe into Bitcoin."
Very good. Very good. Yes.
Good to know those people listen to the podcast. Chris, it's been an extraordinary experiment, actually, because it went up to 215. It went down to about 185. This is a 200 euro investment. This morning it was trading around 196. So. Okay.
So you're near break even.
Near break even, but the level of volatility is just extraordinary from day to day. So for big investors in this, I was going to call it an asset class, I won't. For big investors in this thing, it's just an incredibly volatile ride. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, I want to talk about something far more serious. Far more serious, actually. And we've had that awful news out of Gaza. And Gaza is something that you and I have shied away from talking very much about. We mentioned it a lot in the early days of the conflict, but then for all sorts of reasons which people can guess at, we've not discussed it. I'm not sure that we've got anything to add actually to what everybody else is both saying and thinking about this. And we're conscious of the deep divides that there are in terms of the debate over Gaza. But we've had the appalling civilian casualties of the aid workers, the food aid workers in the last 24 hours. And one of the things that I do every day, actually, is that I write a daily piece. It's one of the gigs that I do that summarizes the war news from around the world. It's a strange task, but I guess somebody's got to do it. And that event, that awful, appalling event, inexcusable event in Israel, prompted me to have a think about civilian casualties and war. And me being me, I had a look at the data. And the data doesn't excuse anything that's happened. It doesn't explain anything that has happened. But it is interesting to give it some background, to give it some context, and for us to perhaps think about how in the future we might think about, deal with these sorts of issues. Because the data for me was jaw-dropping. I knew that wars always produce civilian casualties, but I didn't realize the extent to which it happens. Now, inevitably, there are measurement issues, different statisticians, people who do this sort of exercise, look at different wars and produce different numbers. So there's all those sorts of debates, and I try to summarize them. And the total casualties in war, going back hundreds of years, depending on how you measure it, the civilian casualty rate, so the proportion of civilians that are killed or injured in war as a proportion of the total casualties, ranges between 50 and 90%, as far as I can interpret the numbers. And the sad fact, overlay on that sad fact, is that through the course of the 20th century wars, that civilian casualty rate tended to increase rather than decrease. And I think that's at least a function of the increasing lethality, the increasing effectiveness, if you like, if we're using a horrible word, of the weaponry that is now available to us. So the First World War had a civilian casualty rate, it's widely thought to be about 59%. And the civilian casualties ranged from all sorts of different causes. About 250,000 civilians were killed as a result of poison gas drifting in to their villages and towns in France and Belgium from, you know, the gas, the poison gas, chlorine gas, mustard gas, just drifted into their villages and towns, and they died. We know that starvation has been present in a lot of wars. I was stunned to read that 750,000, 750,000 German civilians died of starvation as a result of the Allied blockade of their country. I knew that it had happened. I hadn't realized it was quite that much. The Bengal famine of 1943, 3 million people, up to 3 million people died. We don't know exactly how many. The civilian casualty rate in Iraq, the wars that they've had there recently, is put as much as 79% of the total civilian casualties. The most lethal war in history was World War II, of course, where they think 70 million people died. Three quarters of those were civilians. Three quarters, maybe two thirds, three quarters. That sort, you know, the majority of the 70 million. So lawyers got to work, quite rightly, in the aftermath of that appalling statistic, if you like, and got to work on human rights laws and rules of war. And a lot of the proportionality rhetoric rules that we talk about in the context of Gaza emerged from that post-World War II effort. Well, I think that what's different about modern warfare is that not that there are civilian casualties. It's in the past there wasn't quite so much outrage about civilian casualties because it was acknowledged that once war starts, you're going to get them. In the just a few weeks after the D-Day landings, 30,000 French people died as a result of Allied bombardment, and so. What's new, I think, is that we are now outraged by the civilian casualties. I think history teaches us that it's war that is the outrage, and that once war starts, civilian casualties, probably most of the total casualties of any war They are inexcusable. They are absolutely unjustifiable. They should never happen. And people who commit war crimes should be prosecuted. Absolutely. But if the past is any guide to the future, Jim, once you start a war, you're going to get the majority of your casualties being civilian. And that's the thing I think we should be outraged by, is the existence of war. And that it's not to accept the inevitability of civilian casualties, but just to recognize that war is always that horrific. And in a way, well, not in a way, it is inexcusable. And that's the thing that we should be most outraged by.
Yeah, the World Bank has estimated that the the infrastructure destroyed in the Gaza is valued at $18.5 billion at the moment, which is, and to put that number into context, it's 97% of the combined GDP of the Palestinian territories in 2022. So, you know, apart from the, of course, these things are all related, but apart from the civilian casualties, you know, the damage that's done to economies, to societies is just extraordinary. And you really would wonder how, in the name of God, this thing is ever going to, we're ever going to get a semblance of normality returning to that part of the world. Another interesting development on the war front, you know, with the US presidential elections imminent on the 5th of November, and with a strong possibility that Trump might be the next president of the United States, NATO is now trying to Trump-proof its funding of Ukraine, and it's trying to secure a five-year, $100 billion aid package for Ukraine to try and offset reductions in support that Trump would inevitably try and drive if he's elected.
I don't know if that's going to involve another vote in Congress for the US part of that funding. I imagine it would. The US has to be a big part of that funding, unless the non-US part of NATO thinks it's going to come up with the cash. Good luck with that if that's the thinking, but I don't know. But if it involves a vote in Congress, it's hard to see how that ever is going to happen, whether they get Trump or not Trump, because the sad fact is that there are a significant number of people in Congress on the Republican side who believe Vladimir Putin when he says almost daily now, I am going to stop at Ukraine. It is ridiculous to think that I will invade anywhere else once I have got Ukraine. And the fact is that I think that Moldova will be next, because he already has a presence there. And if you're in any of the Baltics or Poland in particular, you're right, as indeed those countries are, in the same way the Japanese are getting their islands off Taiwan ready just in case. Those countries are much more attuned to the idea that we are in a pre-war phase for what happens next once if Vladimir Putin takes Ukraine. But the naivety and the stupidity of the Republic, not all of them, but the Republicans who believe Vladimir Putin when he says that he is going to stop at Ukraine is just mind-boggling, because he has said so many times that he wants to reestablish the old Soviet Union. It's as simple as that. That's what you should listen to.
Okay, Chris, listen, great to talk again. I apologize again for the quality of my sound. I will work on it.
It wasn't too bad, Jim. So looking forward to talking to you next time. And congratulations on the move to Dungarvan. Dublin's loss.
Oh, no, I haven't left Dublin.
Well, you have today anyway.
I'm now a dual citizen. Good luck.
Take it easy.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.